Hey, good game today. Go Green. Hey, Jaden Akins, though, about yammed it on that one guy. Gosh, if you would have hit that one. Who's in the Salt Company Bracket Challenge? Who signed up? Okay, too late if you didn't. Who? Does anybody in here still have a perfect bracket? Anybody? Okay, let's go. Anybody else have Michigan State going all the way? Let's see, Michigan State all the way. Who thinks they're going to win it? Anybody think they're going to win it? Absolutely not. I'll tell you what, it feels like every year, I can almost guarantee you that the person who wins this bracket challenge knows absolutely nothing about basketball whatsoever. It's almost guaranteed. That's why it's called Madness, March Madness. That's certainly true if Spencer Good wins, for sure. I promise you, it's going to be somebody who knows nothing about basketball. They likely chose the team based on, I don't know, their favorite color. They know nothing about basketball. They do not know where Gonzaga is on a map. They could not point to that team. They probably picked it by best logo. Or it'll be that science guy who just ran some math, some algorithms, doesn't know anything about basketball, but he knows every player, every strength, weakness, mama's name, whatever. But he's never touched the basketball in his life. Somebody who can talk a lot about basketball, but he knows nothing about basketball. It's one thing to be able to talk about ball. It's another thing to know ball. It's like this week when you watch the games, you guys know the commentators, like the analysts, usually before or after the game, there's usually like four of them. There will be three of them who look like basketball players. They're athletic, 6'8", but then there's always one guy, usually on the left, usually a white dude with glasses, never played basketball in his life. Okay, I love Ernie Johnson. But goodness, it's one thing to talk about basketball. It's another thing to actually know how to play basketball. I think that's why I'm excited. A lot of people are excited about Tom Brady. I think Tom Brady is going to be calling games on CBS this fall. Do you guys know that? He's going to be doing commentating. And I don't like Tom Brady whatsoever, but I'm excited. I'm excited because it's interesting to actually hear someone like the greatest football minds talk about sports, not just because they know about it, but because they've actually done the thing. In fact, I think LeBron James has a podcast. I've been listening to clips of it all week. I don't like LeBron either, but the podcast is interesting because you got a guy who knows basketball, who doesn't just know it in theory, but he knows it in practice. It's interesting to learn about someone or to learn about something from someone who actually knows it, because it's one thing to know about something. It's another thing to be about something. And in 1 John, that's what we're talking about tonight. So if you have a Bible, we've been studying the book of 1 John this semester, and John is going to talk about a lot of things in this book, but there is one thing that he's going to keep coming back to, one skill, one thing that Christians ought to be good at, not just talking about it, but ought to be about it. He's going to basically say, if you want to know who a Christian is, there's going to be one thing, one skill, one marker of a true Christian. That if you can see this one thing in someone, it's the defining mark of a Christian. And it's not Chacos or Burks in the summertime. It's not water bottles or stickers or a Salt Company t-shirt. It's not a perfect connection group record or attendance. It's not a marked up Bible. It's not a salty on your shelf. It's not your name on the fall retreat trophy. No, the defining thing of a Christian is love. It's love, right? I mean, we've talked about this in 1 John, and we're going to continue talking about it in the book of 1 John. He says that if you want to know what a Christian is, they ought to love people, that you and I and every Christian in the room should be about love. In fact, that's the first thing he's going to say in the text tonight, 1 John 3:11. He says this. He says, "For this is the message that you have heard from the beginning, that you and I are to love one another." That Christians should be known by their love, and specifically love for one another. That you and I have been shown great love, and now we should show great love to one another. And if we didn't, man, that would be more madness than March, right? Like a Christian without love. It'd be like a dentist who has jacked up teeth. Madness, right? Okay, an overweight trainer would be madness. A fan of Michigan sports with an ounce of integrity would be madness. In the same way, a Christian who has not love would be madness. That you and I, every Christian, should be known by their love. John says that this is the message from the beginning, that it was true back then, and it ought to be true today, that Christians should be marked by their love. In fact, one of the reasons, the main reason why Christianity spread throughout the Roman Empire was not because of brute force or powerful persuasion. No, it spread because of radical love. In fact, Julian the Apostate, he was a Roman emperor. He hated Christianity back then. He wanted to snuff it out, like kill it before it started. He said this to one of his colleagues about Christians. He said, it's a scandal among the Jews that there are no beggars among them. He says, these godless Galileans, that's what he called the Christians because they rejected the Roman pantheon, all their gods. He said, these godless Galileans care not only for their own poor, but for ours as well. Or in other words, he's like, I want to kill these guys, but it's really hard because they're really nice people. They care not just for the poor Christians, but for the poor Romans. And that's doing something. You see, back then, the Romans, they didn't give a rip about the poor. Okay, if you became poor or you were sick, the Romans would ditch you. Like if a plague came to a town, the Romans left, but the Christians stayed. They stayed. They said, if you're sick, I'll love you. Oh, you're a Roman? I don't care. I'm going to love you. I'll care for you. One person wrote about Christians back then. He said, they love each other before they even know each other. You see, it was confusing to the world, and it changed the world. And so tonight, we're going to talk about love. But John, he's going to do something tonight that's actually a bit convicting. He's going to basically say, hey, we can talk about love all day long in theory, but the question is, do we actually love in practice? It's one thing to talk about love, to love love, like to love the idea of love, but do we actually love people, not in the clouds, but on the streets? Are we going to be people who don't just talk about love in this room, but who actually love in the world? Because it's one thing to talk about something, it's another thing to be about something. And so John, he's going to try to bring love down for us in our text by giving us two different examples. Okay, in this text, he's going to give us two examples, two ways of living, two streams of living. If you remember last week, he basically said there's only two types of people in the world. There's children of the devil and children of God. Okay, and on these streams, the fountainhead of the streams is either the devil or God. And depending on what happens in the stream, you can look back and see who you belong to and what's in your heart. How you love reveals something about your life. And so this is what John's going to do for us. Two different examples. He's going to prop them up, and then he's going to hold a mirror up. And he's going to say, which one do you look like the most? Because the way that you love is going to communicate something about your life. And so that's what we're doing tonight. Look down with me. We're going to go back to our text. Look at verse 11. We'll start there again. Verse 11 of 1 John 3. It says this. For this is the message that you've heard from the beginning, that we should love one another. We should not be like Cain, who was of the evil one and murdered his brother. And why did he murder him? Because his own deeds were evil and his brother's righteous. And so right here at the beginning of our text, John, he takes us back to the beginning, not just the message from the beginning, but also a story in the beginning of the Bible. He takes us back to the book of Genesis, chapter 4, to give us our first illustration, our first example, this man named Cain. And maybe you know the story of Cain. Okay, it says that Cain murdered his brother. And you might go, well, why did he murder his brother? And it says it because his deeds were evil. And you might go, well, what were his deeds that were evil? Well, you got to go read Genesis chapter 4. But Cain had a brother, and his brother's name was Abel. And those two went to worship God. Okay, and Abel, he brought the best that he had and the first that he had to God. Okay, it was an act of trust. He came to God and said, God, I trust you, and I'm going to give you my first. Even if I don't even know if I'm going to get seconds one day, I'm going to give you my first as an act of trust to God. Cain didn't do that. Okay, Cain, he did his little religious service, but the book of Hebrews tells us that he had no faith. And so God says to Cain, hey, I don't care about your offering if you don't trust me. Like there's no gratefulness there. And so with Cain, you got no trust in God. There's no gratefulness for God. And so Cain begins to resent God. and Cain begins to think, well, fine, okay, if God's not going to provide for me, I'm going to take care of myself. I'm going to get mine. I'm going to live for myself. And listen, when you begin to think like that, okay, I'm going to go for mine. I'm going to care for just me. Man, you start to care about yourself a lot more than you care about other people. And you also start to resent other people who trust in God and who are blessed by God. You see, you read our text and you can see it. Cain, he didn't kill Abel because Abel was the bad guy. No. Cain killed Abel not because Abel was evil, but because Abel was good. You see, it was jealousy that led to the first murder. And he wasn't jealous over Abel's superior sacrifice. No, he was jealous because of Abel's superior righteousness, that he had the righteousness of God in him. And so he became jealous. It's the same kind of jealousy that the Jews had for Jesus when they nailed him to the cross. And you know this, and I know this, because we find it in our own hearts. Jealousy kills. It kills. Jealousy leads to resentment. Resentment leads to hate. And hate, it leads to murder. And that's what happens here. You see, Cain was in this stream, the stream of hate. And back at the fountainhead, it says, was the evil one, the devil. You can see it. Cain was of the evil one. Or in other words, Adam and Eve were not the only ones influenced by the devil. No, here, the apple, it doesn't fall far from the tree in Genesis. See, Cain, he gave his heart not to love, but to hate. And as it carried on in his heart, it placed a knife in his hand, and he killed his brother. The end of the stream is murder. And so John here, he holds up Cain, and he holds up a mirror, and he makes you ask the question, are you like him? And you might be thinking to yourself at this point, nah, Zach, I ain't never killed a guy. I ain't never taken a man's life. I'm not like Cain. And are you saying that all non-believers are murderers? There's no way. Listen, Cain was the extreme. Like the end of the stream, like level 10, like all the way down the road of hatred is murder. Because this is what murder does here. Murder is simply saying, hey, I'm going to go get mine. I'm going to live for myself. I'm going to do whatever it takes to get what I want, even if it means I'm going to take everything from you, even your own life. That's what murder is. It's the extreme. But the point is this, not everyone in the stream goes that far. You see, John, look at what he does next. It's really interesting. Look at verse 13. He says, do not be surprised, brothers, that the world hates you. We know that we have passed out of death into life because we love the brothers. Whoever does not love abides in death. Verse 15. Everyone who hates his brother is a murderer. And you know that no murderer has eternal life abiding in him. You see what he does there, right? He does something similar here to what Jesus does in Matthew chapter 6, right? The Sermon on the Mount. Jesus says something to the effect, hey, you may not have murdered anyone, but if you've been angry at your brother in your heart, if you hate someone, you've committed murder of the heart. You see, Jesus, he takes it deeper here. Jesus is more worried about our attitude than our actions. He takes it down to the heart. And this is what John does here. He says it's the heart of hate that leads to the taking of life. And in some sense, you guys know this, like murder and hate, they have the same effect. Like when you hate someone, and you guys know this, like when you hate someone, you're basically saying to them, you're as good as dead to me. Like you're as good as dead. You're dead to me. Hatred is the wish that another person was no longer there. It's a refusal to acknowledge them as a person, like to see the image of God in that person. Like whether it's from jealousy or pain, what hatred does is it goes from a heart that ignores people to a heart that wants to get rid of someone, to a heart that wants to hurt someone, and ultimately to a heart that wants to take the life. This is what hatred does. And to John, there's only two options. You're either going to love someone or you're going to hate someone. And you can see the end of verse 14. He equates does not love with the word hates at the beginning of verse 15. They are the same to John. There is no other option. Like, you might want to sit on the fence when it comes to someone in the room, but John says there is no options here. You either love the person or you hate the person. You see, what John is saying here is that it's weird if Jesus is our king and he loved his enemies, and yet we have a short temper with ours. He says that's weird. It makes no sense. Christians are called not to hate, but to love. And you can see it here, right? Look at verse 14. It says, we know that we have passed out of death into life because we love the brothers. That you and I have passed out of the stream of death into the stream of life. Okay, a divine migration. We've moved from a stream of hate to a stream of love. But check it, not because we're good people, not because we jump from this stream to this one. No, because Jesus came and got us out of the stream of death, and he placed us into that stream. We love because he loved us first. This is why we love. And now, love is our proof or our confidence that we have passed over. Genuine love for the believers is proof of the new birth. That if you have love, we've already talked about this, it proves to your heart that you are a child of God. Love is not the cause of the moving over, but it is the proof of it. We're called to love one another, which means this. Love, this is not a trivial thing. Love is not a cute thing. It's not an optional thing. No, love is a matter of death and life for the Christian. And so the question is this, do you love the people in this room? Do you love the other believers in your life? Like, do you see them as Jesus' people? Like as sheep who are part of the same flock? As sons and daughters, part of the same family? Like as people who also bear the burden and the cross of Jesus Christ? And do you love them? And do you delight in the company of Christians? That's the evidence that you are not of this world, but that you belong to Jesus, the one who truly loved, right? Like, look at verse 16. You keep reading. This is Jesus. Verse 16, by this we know love, that he laid down his life for us, and we ought to lay down our lives for the brothers. He says, by this we know love, that Jesus laid down his life for us. You see, John here, he sets Jesus up as our other example. Cain is the example of what love is not. Jesus is the example of what love is. He laid down his life for us. That's what love is. Like, that's the reason why the best movies have this kind of love. You guys know Lion King? Okay, Mufasa saves his son Simba from a stampede. He lays down his life for his son. Independence Day, do you guys know this movie? Crazy pilot Russell flies into the alien ship, saves humanity. He gives his life to save the world. Lord of the Rings, Gandalf saves the fellowship. One of my favorites, A Quiet Place number one. John Krasinski sacrifices his life and gets absolutely wrecked by those sound-eating monsters. You guys know what I'm talking about? He saves his wife, I think in real life, and his kids. We could keep going, and you can think of them. Saving Private Ryan, The Avengers, Harry Potter, Hunger Games, Armageddon. Listen, our hearts are captivated and compelled by this kind of love. Why? Because your heart is tuned to the song of Jesus Christ. You were made to see this love. You were made to want to see a sacrifice like Jesus Christ. It is the greatest sacrifice, and it meets our deepest needs. This is why we're compelled by this. This is love to the extreme. This is love taken all the way down. All the way down this stream, it's not a life-taking love, it's a life-giving love. Or in other words, murder and sacrifice are the opposites. One says this, I will take your life for my good. The other says this, I will give my life for your good. That's what it is. Cain said to Abel, I'm going to take your life for my own good. But Jesus says to us, I will give my life for your good. This is what love is. This is the gospel message. There is no greater love than this. John 15 says this. Greater love has no one than this, that someone lay down his life for his friends. But go back to verse 16, because the verse, it doesn't stop with Jesus' love for us, but it goes on to talk about our love for other people. Look at it, verse 16. By this we know love, that he laid down his life for us, and so we ought to lay down our lives for the brothers. You see, John's point here is that the sacrifice of Jesus is not just an act to be admired, it's an example to follow. That Jesus laid down his life for us, for our good, and so we ought to lay down our lives for the good of other people. It says ought to. It's not just a logical conclusion, it's a moral obligation that we are compelled by this love. But John, he's going to do something next in verse 17 that's kind of unique. Because I think at this point, a lot of us in the room, we can get on board with this. It's like, okay, if I'm ever in a situation, like if a situation ever presents itself where I have to die for someone in this room, like give my life to save humanity, okay, if the sound monsters come, I would die for you people, okay? This, a lot of people will say this, okay? Jesus, I'll do anything for you. I'll take a grenade for you, put my hand on a blade for you, jump in front of a train for you. I'll do anything for Jesus. I'll do it. Like if I had to take a bullet for one of you, I'll do it. A lot of people will say this. But then John's going to do something next in verse 17 that's very interesting. Look at what it says. But if anyone has the world's goods and sees his brother in need, and yet closes his heart against him, how does God's love abide in him? You see what he does here, right? He moves it down. Like he brings love down. He says, we ain't talking about love in the clouds. No, this is love on the streets. And you can see it. He goes from plural brothers in verse 16 to singular brother in verse 17. It says, but if anyone has the world's goods and sees his brother in need. Okay, that word goods there is the Greek word bios, like biology, or it's the word life. Like if you have, it basically means the means of life, like the things that sustain life, like the things of the world that sustain life. He's not talking about rich people here. He's talking about anyone who has the basic necessities of life. So think food, think money, think clothing, material possessions. He says that if you have the bios of the world and you see a brother in need and yet you close your heart against him. Okay, that phrase closes his heart. It literally means to lock it up, like to close the door, like to slam the door and not allow emotions to go through. And like if you lock your heart up, well, in other words, if you close the door in the face of someone who has need. He says, if you got the world's bios and you see someone who needs it and yet you lock up your heart, how can you say you love your brother? That's what he says here. He says that's the opposite of the love of Jesus. You see, maybe in this room, we don't have anybody who's murdered anyone. And maybe right now, you don't hate someone actively. But what John is doing here is he's saying the first step to those things, maybe it's not murder, maybe it's not hate, but maybe it's indifference. Indifference. Do you show indifference to those who have need? Or do you show compassion? Because indifference and compassion is the first step on the way to sacrifice or to murder. That's what he's saying here. And you got to see what John is saying here is it's powerful and it's purposeful. He's making the point that it's one thing to be willing to go to the extreme things, but are you willing to do the small things? Like, it's one thing to say, I'd take a bullet if one ever comes, but that's convenient. Because odds are nobody's going to get shot. But are you willing to not just give your life, but to give your stuff? Like, are you willing to sacrifice not just your life, but sacrifice your time, your money, your bios? You see, I think John is getting at something that we need to hear today. It's convicting. It's one thing to love humanity with a capital H. It's another thing to love humans, lowercase, individuals, people right in front of your face. C.S. Lewis, he says, loving everybody in general may be an excuse for loving nobody in particular. He says, loving everyone in general, it might just be an excuse from loving someone in particular. You see, love, it doesn't just say, I would die for that person. It says, I do die for that person. I die every day. You die to self. Die to your own wants, your own needs, the day-to-day sacrifices that no one notices and no one applauds. You see, martyrdom, it's heroic and it's exhilarating. But most of the time, love is hard. It's difficult. It hurts. Sometimes dying is easy, but living and loving, it's harder. See, John, he goes on in verse 18 with the final encouragement. Look at what it says. Little children, let us not love in word or talk, but in deed and in truth. And so the question tonight is just that. Is your love all talk or is it action? Like, do we actually love each other? Not just in theory, but in reality. Not just to the extreme, but in the small. Do we show compassion to people in this room or indifference? You see, I want to do what John's doing here. I want to bring love down. So let's pause. What does it look like practically to love? Like, what does he mean if you have the world's goods and you don't give it to other people? What are the world's goods? Well, there's a few different ways you can dice it up. But I think there's at least four things included in John's idea for bios, life-giving things, that I think love would compel us to give and not keep. And here they are, four things. Number one, give your money. Number two, give your time. Number three, give your words. And number four, give your heart. Give your money, give your time, give your words, and give your heart. What I mean, first of all, give your money, or in other words, your resources. Okay, you could lump in possessions, food, clothing, whatever you have. The reality is, if you're in this room in 2024 America, you have more than most. And the question is, are you giving your things to those in need? Like, both in the church and outside the church. First, you can give your money. Number two, you can give your time. Honestly, sometimes it's harder to part with our time than it is our money, right? Like, are you giving your time to those in need? Or are you spending your time on yourself and on your own needs? Okay, maybe the best example would be, how do you respond when you get interrupted? Like when you're doing something, or you're working on a project, and then someone interrupts you. How do you respond to that? Like, do you... Like, likely that person's interrupting you because they have a need. Like, they need something from you. Do you respond with frustration or anger, or do you see that person as a divine opportunity given to you by God to love someone in need? That's how we ought to view every interaction. No matter how trivial or silly the thing might be, do you love the people with your time? Give your time. Number three, give your words. Whether you realize it or not, your words are powerful. Okay, Proverbs says that life and death are in the power of the tongue. And so the question is this, do you use your words to bring life? Okay, to give bios to people. When's the last time you encouraged someone? Like, when's the last time you paid a compliment to someone? That you gave life-giving words to someone who is starved with encouragement in the cynical world that we live in. Your words have power. When's the last time you used them to lift people up? Or maybe better yet, When's the last time you used your words to give not just encouragement to the heart, but the words of encouragement to the soul, Jesus Christ, the message of Jesus? When's the last time you've used your words to share the message of Jesus Christ? The most life-giving words there are. When's the last time, Christian in the room, that you shared the gospel with someone? Because I think you can take that idea and put it back into John's verse. If you have the world's bios, or in other words, if you have the words of life, and you see a brother in need, or in other words, someone who doesn't know Jesus, and you lock up your heart and you don't share it, well, how can you say that you love that person? We're called to give our words to bring life. And lastly, maybe a combination of all of those things would be to give your heart, to give your heart to someone. And I think you guys know what I mean when I say give your heart to someone. It means you allow your heart to care for someone. Like you allow them into your heart and you give it to them. You begin to empathize with that person. You begin to bear their burdens for them. Like whether it's listening to someone or sitting next to someone in silence, giving them a hug, or maybe the best way that you can share your heart and give your heart to someone is through consistent intercessory prayer. When's the last time, out of love, you prayed for someone? Because I would make the argument, there might not be a better way on this earth to give your heart to someone than to pray for them. Because what's more loving than taking a person and their needs before God and praying and asking for God to bless them? That's the most loving thing you can do, to go to battle for someone, to enter into a spiritual battle that's going to take spiritual energy from you to intercede for other people. When's the last time you've done that? I'm convicted by my lack of prayer for my wife, for my baby, honestly, all of you. It's convicting. But the best thing you can do to pray and to give your heart to someone is to pray for them, to give your heart to the people who need it. You know, as I was thinking about the sermon and really those four ways to show love, it made me think of a ministry that our church has partnered with that honestly, if you're thinking, Zach, how can I use these things? All four of those things you can actually use at something like this. It's a ministry called the City Rescue Mission, and the guys who lead it are actually part of our church. Okay, the City Rescue Mission, maybe you've seen it on Grand River in Lansing. It's a place that provides food, shelter, and hope to men, women, and children in Lansing. Okay, I think it's been around since 1911, and every single night, they have 250 men, women, and children stay there, stay sheltered there. They give them food, clothing, but also they share Jesus with them. So I texted Brenton, he's in the back. He's one of my friends, he helps lead this. And I asked him, I said, bro, in what ways could a room like this serve your ministry? And this is what he said in his text message yesterday. He said this: the first thing they can do is pray for the people. He said, it's the coolest thing watching guys lean in with a Bible during chapel service, reading their Bible before bed, or having gospel conversations with the staff. He said, a guest at the women's shelter got saved last week. That's something to be excited about. Number two, you can pray. Number two, he said, give. He said, we just remodeled our new building that we just bought, but we received no government funding so that we're not restricted in telling people about Jesus. Praise God. We are completely supported by donations, or consider donating your used clothes to the mission rather than getting money from Plato's Closet. He said, you can do that. And lastly, he said, serve. He says that you can give your time and you can volunteer. You can go online, you can volunteer, you can serve food, you can actually speak your words at a children's chapel, you can sort through donations, or in other words, this is an opportunity to give your money, your time, your words, and your heart to people who need it. Okay, if you want to get involved in something like that, you can Google it, you can come find us. I think it's City Rescue Mission, BARescuer.org. You can look that up. But I say all that to say this. Man, I wonder what kind of impact a room like this could have if we truly loved the people that God has placed in our lives. I mean, 500 Spartans for Jesus, like a small room can make a big impact. To be people who show love because we've been shown love. You know, it's been fun. We've been doing leader interviews all week for Salt Company. And we've been talking with people who are interested in leading and serving Salt Company next year. And time again, I'm telling you, we sat at coffee shops and the union and we've talked to people. And time again, it's the same story. Here's the story. They came because of the love of a friend that invited them. They stayed because of the love of Jesus that saved them. And they applied to lead because of their love for others that compels them. Time and time again, that's the story. You see, it's love that compels them. It's love that saved them. And it was love that invited them here in the first place. This place is what it is because of people like you. People who love people. People who love Jesus. Not perfect in love, but progressing in love. Okay, a place that tries, that stumbles, that apologizes, that forgives. A people marked by the transforming love of Jesus and trying our best to do the same. And so to close, I want to go back to our motivation for love. We don't just love because it feels good. We don't just love so people can see a loving group or get something out of it. No, we love because of Jesus, right? Not just because of who he is, but what he did for us. Verse 16, by this we know love, that he laid down his life for us. Jesus laid down his life for you. I think sometimes, like, that really hits us. Like, when we feel the magnitude of it, and it's awesome, and we sing, Jesus laid down his life for us. But other times, man, we grow numb to it. Like, that reality and the magnitude of it, we just get numb. Jesus laid down his life for us. Okay, but your heart is cold to that. And sometimes, we need to be woken up to the love of Jesus. And so sometimes sermons can do that. A lot of times songs can do that. Sometimes illustrations and stories can do that. It can warm up our love for Jesus. And I'll never forget when I heard a pastor share a story to illustrate this kind of love. And so he tells the story of a group of American prisoners back in World War II who were made to do hard labor in prison camp. Okay, so they're imprisoned on the other side, and they're made to do hard labor all day. And so they're out there, and they basically were given a shovel to dig holes all day long. And so they would go out every single day, and they would dig holes with their shovel. And at night, they would come back, and they would give an account for the tools that they had. And so one evening, 20 of these American soldiers come back from digging holes, and they put their shovels on the racks, and they stand in line. And the guard comes in, and he counts those shovels, and he only counts to 19. And so he looks at the 20 guys, and he yells at them and says, who left his shovel? Where's the final shovel? And it's silent. No one goes forth. And he yells again. He says, if the guy who left his shovel doesn't step forward, I'm going to shoot 5 of you. Again, silence. Nobody steps forward. And then a second passes, 2 seconds, 5 seconds. And then a 19-year-old boy steps forward. Raise your hand if you're 19. Put your hands down. He steps forward, 19 years old, head down. And he steps forward and he says, it was mine. So the guard takes him to the side, shoots him in the head. And he looks at the other 19 and he says, if you ever leave your shovel again, you'll be like him. The guard leaves. This is a true story. Guard leaves. And they're looking over this 19-year-old body here. And then they count the shovels. There were 20. He miscounted. And so at this moment, imagine those guys standing over that 19-year-old boy. He's younger than all of them. I mean, imagine what's going through their hearts. Or better yet, imagine the boy before he steps forward. Like, imagine what's going through his head in those seconds as that guy is about to shoot 5 people. He probably had his whole life flash in front of him. He's probably weighing his entire life. Man, if he gets out of this, he's going to get a wife someday. He's going to have kids someday. He's going to get a new car. He's going to go fishing with his dad. All of that flashes before him. And yet he steps forward and he dies for his friends, because no greater love has man than this, that a man might die for his friends. You see, that story is just a shadow of the greater story. That story points to Jesus. It's very similar, but it's also very different. See, the story would only make sense if Jesus was the only one who brought a shovel and all of us forgot our shovels. Like, if anybody deserved to live, it's Jesus. If anybody deserved to die, it's us. And yet, he steps forward and he dies for us. He lays down his life for us. This is the gospel message, the perfect one for the imperfect ones, the righteous for the unrighteous, or better yet, the loving one for a bunch of unloving ones. And then he makes us lovely in him. That's the gospel. He steps forward. And so would we be people who are captivated by that love and compelled to love the world around us? You got to get your mind focused on Jesus. It's the only thing that's going to move your heart and move your feet to the people around you. Would we be people like that? Let me pray for us to that end. God, give us the hearts, the hands, the eyes, and the feet of Jesus Christ. Help us to live like he lived and to love like he loved every day, every moment. Not just laying down his time, his resources, his heart, but his very life. God, help us actually love indeed and truth, to not just be a group of people who talk about love, but who actually love. God, give us grace when we fail to love like you and to love your people as we should. But God, I pray, give us a picture of Jesus Christ, his blood shed for us, his life given for us. And out of the overflow of thankfulness to Jesus Christ, would we love those around us? Help us actually do it, even this weekend. It's in Jesus' name I pray. Amen.